This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello there, how are you? Great to have you along this afternoon. Today, a Perth butcher says in the last sort of 5 or 6 weeks, he's really noticed that chicken meat sales have dropped by around about 25%, and he thinks it's due to concerns over bird flu. And he's not the only one. There are a few other meat suppliers also saying the same sort of thing about their sales in chicken meat. Also today, just over 10,000 feral pigs have been shot from helicopters from land areas surrounding Geraldton in the state's Midwest. I wonder if you've got the same situation at your place. Let me know on the text 0448 922 604. 6 past 12 here on the Country Hour on the ABC WA. First up today, war, instability and port bottlenecks in the Black Sea region could result in a short, sharp wheat price rally. Dennis Woznesensky is the Commonwealth Bank's agricultural and sustainability economist. Dennis, what movements are you seeing in wheat prices globally and also on the domestic market?
Yeah, well, we've seen a price rise overseas. So if you look at Chicago Board of Trade, which is the bellwether for global wheat prices, has gone up about 15% since the start of July. And our prices here in Australia have also started to rise. And if you look at Kwinana APW1 prices, the spot price, that's gone up probably to the highest level since mid to early 2025. So there has been a rise. And it's due primarily to what's happening in the Black Sea. So Black Sea this year is meant to harvest a near record crop. That's a second one after last year's record. And then you may think, you know, why are prices going up? Well, the thing is, it's not that they're harvesting a record crop. That's not the main price driver. It is the fact that they can't actually get that crop out of the Black Sea because Ukraine and Russia have been hitting each other's ports pretty hard since mid-July.
So those prices that we're seeing, that rise in the wheat price, is a direct result of that situation?
Yeah, that's right. So the impact of Ukraine and Russia, the war, has been pretty dormant on wheat prices for a little while. Now there's been occasional spikes, but it's been somewhat dormant. And whenever something happens in the Black Sea, the market hasn't really responded. Whereas here, Ukraine's been hitting Russian ports and actually vessels, and Russia's retaliated and hit Ukrainian deep sea ocean ports as well. And Ukraine, up to this point, was exporting around 90% of all their grains and oilseeds via those deep sea ocean ports. And even if they can get them up and running, while there's attacks, a lot of vessel owners won't want to go there. And then for Russia, well, Ukraine impacted two export regions. One is the Sea of Azov, that accounted for around a quarter of Russia's export capacity. When that area was shut down, about 90% of the grain moved to the Novorossiysk deep sea ocean ports that Russia has. So 90% of the nation's grains and oil seeds are being exported through that region. And then in that region, Ukraine hit two of the main three ports, and the third one was just shut down due to safety concerns. So you basically have exports out of both countries grinding to a halt to some of the worst levels we've seen since the war began.
So how long can we expect to see a rise in the wheat prices? That's all going to depend on how long the current conflict continues. Is that your thought?
That's exactly it, because there's no, apart from the logistical bottleneck now, there's not much justification for higher prices, because you have a record crop being produced in the Black Sea and harvested now. So Ukraine, Russia, Romania combined are producing a really, really large crop. And if it wasn't for the bottleneck, there wouldn't be much reason for prices to move higher. But right now they have. And the question is for how long, and I think it's anyone's guess how long a conflict lasts for, or this specific escalation in the conflict. So for now, prices are moving higher, but you have to keep in mind that that price spike is likely, or it has a high probability of being temporary, because if they do reach a truce, those prices can go down pretty quickly. So I guess the key message there is potential for a decent price rally, but it could be a very short one.
Right. And I guess it's from a low base. That's what we're hearing from the growers here in Western Australia. They've kind of gone to canola in a much bigger way this season, mainly because there was the price potential with canola as opposed to what they could see for wheat.
Yeah, the profit margins around planting were not good for wheat. So a lot of farmers switched over to feed barley. They switched over to canola. Whereas now the profit margins for wheat are looking better because we're really seeing this price spike in wheat offshore, and it's starting to translate locally here as well. And you've actually seen the price of wheat start to rip away and tear away from feed barley as well, whereas before they were sitting pretty close to one another.
What effect is this situation, the war, the instability in the Black Sea region, having on canola? What's happening with canola at the moment?
Well, it's not just the war impacting grains. It's also canola, because Russia and Ukraine account for about a fifth of the world's canola exports. So there's not that many countries that export it in large volumes. It's Australia, Canada, Ukraine, and Russia to a large extent. And Ukraine and Russia account for about a fifth, so 20%. So in theory, if they can't open those ports up, that should be something that's supportive for canola as well. Again, could be for a very short period of time. A lot of people say, you know, why can't Ukraine and Russia just move it overland into Europe? Well, there's a lot of sanctions against Russia. And for Ukraine, there's a lot of difficulty in getting their crops into Europe as well, even if it's for transit, because there are import quotas now, because local farmers were upset that their prices were lower because Ukrainian grain was coming in there. There's been actual union strikes as well, blocking railways. It's not that easy to reroute that grain or oilseed.
And Dennis, we find you today at the Darren Field Days here in Western Australia. Yes. And that's the noise we can hear in the background. What's it like at the moment? I know you've only just arrived, but how does it look?
Yeah, that's right. I have just arrived. Looked at some crops along the way, but it's quite sunny, and there's a lot of people. I was here last year as well. Seems like the crowd numbers have really come up.
And what did the crops look like as you travelled to Darren this afternoon?
Looking positive overall, but I'm yet to get a good sense on the ground, because the data is showing that it's obviously down on last year in terms of production prospects. But you look at BOM's 3-month outlook, and I know that's a long time to outlook for. But it is looking like there's a chance of above median rainfall for a good chunk of WA. So let's wait and see what happens. Not looking as good as last year, obviously, but some prospects for a bit of improvement.
Dennis, great to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Dennis Woznesensky is the Commonwealth Bank's agriculture and sustainability economist. And we'll pick up on the weather situation for Western Australia just after 12:30. We'll call into the Bureau of Meteorology and then look at the rainfall figures. I mean, the southwest got a lot of rain in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning. And I'm curious to know if it's raining at your place today. Let me know, 0448 922 604. The Bureau will bring us up to speed with what's going on, where that rain might fall for the rest of the week, just after 12:30. 12:12 on the ABC WA. WA fishermen have been told the State Fisheries Minister, Jackie Jarvis, will now handle all compensation negotiations associated with the closure of commercial demersal fishing along a 900-kilometre stretch of the WA coast. This follows the minister's decision to end an arrangement with a Perth barrister who was originally tasked with the job. The West Coast demersal fishery was controversially shut down 9 months ago, and the government had $20 million on the table to compensate or buy out commercial operators. WA Fishing Industry Council Interim Chief Executive Manu Daniels says it's unclear how the new negotiation arrangements will affect the compensation process.
My understanding is that the minister has concluded arrangement with a negotiator that she had previously appointed. We don't have any more information at this stage about the reason why and what that approach was taken. So we're waiting to see if some more information are going to come through, and also waiting on more information about how the process going to go forward. At this stage, we haven't received anything formal. My understanding is that the process will keep going as it was. It's just instead of having that third-party negotiator in place, the minister will do that herself.
That third-party negotiator was Delaney Quinlan, who is a Perth barrister, and she had been appointed as the minister's delegate to basically negotiate with applicants who were eligible for compensation. And now the minister is saying that she will handle those negotiations herself. Are you concerned that that will cause a further delay to demersal fishers receiving compensation payments, given it's now 9 months on since their fishery was closed?
So I've stressed to the Minister Office and the Department that we can't afford any more delay. When you really look, the fishermen had 1 month warning that they will not be able to fish. As you say, it's been 9 months and they haven't seen any income. They haven't been able to generate any income. It's not right. At the very least, the government could have either let them fish until the process of compensation was dealt with, or have the compensation process ready and everything done prior. It is absolutely unacceptable to have people not being able to pay their bills, not being able to afford living, basically, and basic needs, and take that long to sort out the process.
So you're saying you've made it clear to government that fishers can't afford any more delays, but fishers that I've spoken to have said, well, we're worried that there will be a delay because obviously you've had a third party handling these discussions. They're now moving in-house. There's a changeover. Our government isn't known for working at a great pace, so they can't afford a delay. But do you think that is inevitable with this change?
Look, the hope is that it will speed up the process. That is the hope. It is not acceptable, and I can't truly say that this is a good process. It is not a good process when we are, as you say, 9 months on, and fishermen haven't seen any compensation and are left in limbo. I mean, the impact on the mental health is devastating. There is not 1 week at Wafik where we don't get phone calls or emails of fishermen that are truly distressed. This is part of our daily life at Wafik now, and it's been since December.
And is the majority of that distress, I mean, is that alleviated by a compensation payment coming through? Is it as simple as that?
Financially will bring relief, but there is still the loss of the identity and being able to be a fisherman and losing a business that you have spent years to build. This will never go away with compensation. And there is also the issue that the compensation amount that has been allocated is not enough.
WA Fishing Industry Council Interim Chief Executive Manu Daniels speaking to Joe Prendergast. 17 past 12. We have repeatedly requested an interview with Fisheries Minister Jackie Jarvis. She is at the Dowran Field Days today, and so is one of our reporters, but she didn't have any time to talk. Instead, her office has just sent through a statement, and it says at this time, 7 compulsory fishery adjustment scheme applications have been settled. To ensure remaining negotiations progress as efficiently as possible, the decision was made to conclude the arrangement with a third-party negotiator. Negotiations will now be progressed by the Minister and DPIRD, and valuation experts will continue to provide relevant technical advice required to support negotiations. The statement also says several licence holders have requested compensation amounts well above market value of their entitlements, and work is underway to ensure those claims can be validated and payments are in accordance with taxpayer expectations. This change is about progressing the remaining applications and reaching fair outcomes as quickly as possible. That's the statement just in from the Fisheries Minister's office. 19 past 12. Tomorrow on the Country Hour, you're going to hear about the legal action that's being taken by a group of fishers in the West Coast demersal fishery.
Well, we weren't confident with, one, the approach, the consultation process or anything. And we received absolutely no information on how that compensation package might work. The only thing we did know is that they based it on a certain value, which was based on the buyback 2 years ago. Beginning of August was the planned date that we would arrive at settlement. I can't see us being, all of those fishers, being getting any money for another 3 months.
More from Kalbarri fisher Phil de Graw on the Country Hour tomorrow, 20 past 12.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
AAM Investment Group says it's looking to attract new capital partners or potentially even sell Lejeune Station near the WANT border. AAM took over the property in 2018 and has invested heavily in Lejeune's cropping and cattle operations. The station is nearly 180,000 hectares in size and home to one of Australia's largest private dams. It was almost also earmarked by aquaculture company Seafarms to be the site for a $1.5 billion black tiger prawn farm, which ultimately failed and was last year placed into liquidation. AAM Managing Director Gary Edwards says the property has already received a lot of interest.
We're looking to run a process because we've had a number of interested parties that want to look at either a recapitalisation, so a new investment structure, because the original investment fund that Lejeune is held in is coming to an end here in the next couple of years. But we've also had some inquiries from parties that are wanting to undertake a development project on Lejeune and literally acquire it from the existing fund. So what we're doing is running an open process so that those seeking to acquire the asset can make bids to, and at the same time that anyone seeking to have a new investment structure, that can be put forward also.
Are you able to share anything about those interested parties and what they might be looking to do?
The interested parties are looking to do a range of either extending the existing cattle operations through to undertaking rather significant developments to grow some further crops on Lejeune. Lejeune is very uniquely or has some very unique components in regards to its on-site water license, but also land that's suitable for farming development. And there's a lot of interest in doing that these days in the Northern Territory and the Kimberley region.
How do you explain that interest? What do you think is the reason for it?
Well, I guess, you know, there's a lot of development going on throughout Northern Australia and a lot of understanding that there's underutilised natural resources in the northern part of Australia. In Lejeune's case, you know, it holds a 50,000 megalitre water licence and it's got, you know, an on-site dam storage that is filled by the monsoonal rains, and it's got a black soil floodplain that's highly suitable for more intensive agricultural uses.
What are some of the other key details and features of the property? How big is it and what would the sale include?
Well, the sale, like any recapitalisation or sale event, will deal with the entirety of Lejeune, which is just under 179,000 hectares of grazing land. It's got a portion at the moment where there's four centre pivots being developed for cropping purposes for support of the existing cattle operation. You know, and it's in excess of 30-odd thousand head of cattle that are run on the property. But there's lots of opportunity to expand that through further investment and focus on how you better utilise those water resources.
So the crop production that's currently taking place at Lejeune, is that all for feeding cattle?
Yeah, that's to support the existing cattle enterprise. That what we've been able to do at Lejeune is get our first round weaners out inside the same year that they're branded, which is a pretty unique thing to do. And it actually reduces the grazing pressure on the operation and creates the opportunity that ultimately you can run more cattle on the pastoral lease, which is a pretty significant value these days, given that properties are significant and you want to move the cattle through to market weight as quickly as you can.
$100 million has been suggested as the sale price. Is that accurate or has that just come out of thin air?
Well, I guess we're open to see what the market, what value it puts on it. The reality is that there's been plenty of expressions of interest with those sort of numbers. We actually haven't put a value on it. There's been plenty of people asking about what the number is and, you know, whether it's $100 million or what it ultimately is, that we'll leave that for people to determine the value. You know, properties of this type don't come up very often. And again, that's why it's got the dual interest from new investment structures, but also bidders that want to secure it on their own right.
I understand aquaculture company Seafarms had a lease agreement with AAM for its massive prawn farm project that never took off. Does the failure of that project have anything to do with AAM now wanting to explore options for Lejeune?
Well, I guess it's a timely point that we can now understand and I guess move forward with certainty in regards to what's occurring with that project. It's very, very unfortunate that the Seafarms project hasn't gone ahead, because it was a great concept and would have been an outstanding project had it been achieved. But certainly what it now does is provide clarity as to what we focus on in regards to further development that is not aligned to an aquaculture project. It's more aligned to more conventional farming and intensification on that. And it's utilising the resources and infrastructure that's there to achieve that. It'll be a pretty significant undertaking, but a great opportunity into the future.
So in the 8 years that AAM has owned Lejeune, how have you seen it change?
Well, there's been a lot of investment to date in improving the underlying infrastructure in regards to improving carrying capacity. As I said, we've put in the four centre pivot locations now. There's further approvals for further development at the moment that's currently approved, which is really aimed at growing crops for more production. You know, we're going to put down hopefully close to 6,000 tonnes of silage here in the next couple of months, which is, you know, a great example as to what you can achieve when you've got the ability to grow fodder and, you know, close proximity to the feeding yards. There's obviously been a lot of development, internal road infrastructure, and clearly there's a great sealed road that goes right to the front of Lejeune these days that deals with all of the historic limitations to do with wet weather access. You've got a, you know, significant ability to access the property right throughout the year. So there's been lots of changes in 8 years, and I suspect there'll be a lot more in the next 8 to 10.
How big of a piece is Lejeune in AAM's portfolio right now? And if it sells, what's next for AAM?
Oh, well, at the end of the day, this is obviously held in a specific investment trust. It's not connected with the rest of the AAM investments. It's a very critical part, and it's a great asset now, asset portfolio, one that we'd like to keep. But at the end of the day, we've got to act in the interest here of investors and create these opportunities whereby if there are interested parties, when these fund terms come to an end, they get to explore that. And, you know, ultimately, if the highest bid we get is from someone to be a purchaser, well, that's what it will be. And AAM will focus on what we do in further investing in this sector, maybe in other areas of Australia. But this is an area and it's a region that's highly productive. AAM itself will continue to invest in the region, given the work that we're doing on the Sweetwater project, which is part of the old Ord Stage 3. So AAM won't be leaving in any way, shape or form, but we will be running this open and transparent process. To date, 100% of AAM's investment has all come from Australian investors. There is a lot of interest from both domestic investors, but obviously also offshore investors. So it'll be interesting to see whether, you know, the Australian investment market steps up to the plate here and matches what the foreign investors have been looking to do so far. And I think it's a great opportunity for, you know, large-scale Australian investment funds to get involved and be directly involved in investing in regional and rural Australia.
Managing Director and CEO of AAM Investment Group, Gary Edwards, speaking to Jess Baker. Lejeune Station has been listed for sale or investment via a joint marketing process through Lord and JLL. The real estate firms will now put together a list of interested parties. That'll happen over the next couple of weeks, with AAM expected to make a final decision before the end of the year. 28 past 12. Just over 10,000 feral pigs have been shot from helicopters from land areas surrounding Geraldton in the state's Midwest. The annual cull was done by the Northern Biosecurity Group earlier this year as part of an annual aerial shooting program using the choppers. Group Executive Officer Claire Engelkey says this year, for the first time, the group had access to some areas that are pig hotspots.
We went very well. We had two culls, one in the east and one in the west, and we got just over 10,000 pigs all up, and that was from a combination of 26 days or just over 240 flying hours.
You took out about 12,000 last year, now another 10,000 this year. Were you surprised by those numbers, that backup of another 10,000?
I was a little, but in saying that, we had additional participants this year or additional stakeholders that came on board for this year's, which included lands managed by DBCA and the Water Corporation and traditional owners, Yamaji and Nanda. So we had additional lands, including other private landholders. So we were over new areas in our zones, not just the same ones we visited last year.
So that may have skewed those numbers a little bit.
It may have.
Yeah. Did you find areas that you shot last year, say in the east, there was quite a few pigs from memory.
Mm.
How were the numbers there, those areas that you went back to?
They were lower, I'm happy to report.
That's a win.
Yeah.
What's it say to you about the overall population of pigs that are in this area? Do you think it's more than what we've ever really considered when you can take out, what, 22,000 in 2 years and there's still pigs around?
Yeah, well, it's 22,000 in 12 months, really, if you look at the timing of our culls. So that is alarming and surprising to me, but I'm not living in the landscape all the time. But I think it just indicates we didn't really know how many were there. We still don't know, but I'm getting reports there are fewer. And we're just in the process of organising next year's cull, and I'm really hoping the numbers are lower next time.
And that will be telling, won't it, if you can get back to the same geographical footprint as this year?
Yes, it will.
What is it about this Midwest area that makes it ideal for pigs?
There's no lack of resources. They have access to water and they've got plenty of feed with all of the, you know, the grain growing and then the native vegetation. They've got plenty to keep them going all year round.
Do you think there's people who don't think they have a pig problem, but they do?
Yes, I do. Pigs are very clever as well, so they can hide. So unless you're seeing the pig or seeing evidence of it and you're looking, you might miss it, might miss them.
And so doing this annual cull, that obviously happens once a year, are you hearing from landholders that they're putting the effort into bait and trap during the year as well?
There are many that are. There are some that aren't. They may not recognise they have pigs, but there are a lot of landholders do a lot of work during the year. We're also introducing second aerial culls in some areas into this next financial year to really try and drive the population down if we can.
To try and get some of those ones that might have been missed.
Yes, yeah, yes, okay. Or ones that have been born since. So we've had two additional smaller culls in June and July this year where we got another 200 collectively in two different areas. They're lower areas where they've had lower numbers of pigs, but we're trying to really get them down to nothing if we could. That would be ideal. But I think it's important that we all put in that effort throughout the year to not give them a chance to breed back up, because doing it once a year, they have a chance to get numbers back up if they can.
Well, they're breeding, they can breed quite well, can't they, in terms of the multiplication effect?
Yes, they can have 2 litres a year, really. So you can have one pig at the start, and by the end of that, or two pigs you'll need, won't you? but by the end of the year, you know, that could be 14 pigs.
So it doesn't take long.
No.
It doesn't take long.
Northern Biosecurity Group Executive Officer Claire Engelke speaking to Joe Prendergast about the latest aerial feral pig culling effort over 26 days, which is quite a lot. She's been calling on people to sign up, get involved in the biosecurity group to help get pig numbers down, and it's free to join. 27 to 1, Jonathan Hopper is here with the news headlines.
Good afternoon, Belinda. The Productivity Commissioner says the WA Premier's heavy criticism of the Commission's report on GST crossed a line. Premier Roger Cook labelled the report's authors East Coast clowns, describing the Commission's work as dodgy and deceitful. Angela Jackson says the Commission will be raising Mr Cook's comments when it meets with the WA Treasurer today. A report by two federal Liberals recommends drastically reducing the tobacco excise to tackle the black market. Recent statistics show around 80% of the nicotine Australians consume comes from illicit sources. But the federal government has resisted reducing the excise, arguing it wouldn't work. And the West Coast Fever has re-signed Jamaican defender Kadeann Dehaney for a fourth season. The 29-year-old is two games short of her 50th appearance for the Fever and says the thought of winning a premiership is what motivates her most. Thank you, Belinda.
Jonathan, thank you for that update. It's 27 to 1.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio WA.
Still to come, we will head to Katanning just before the news at 1. Tracy Kilner will be here. She'll go through the yarding and the prices at the sheep market for you today. And we will also take a look at chicken meat sales, because there's one Perth butcher saying that he's really noticed over the last few weeks or so that chicken meat sales have really dropped away, around about 25% or so. He thinks it's due to concerns over bird flu. So we'll catch up with him shortly here on the Country Hour. First, let's make our way to the Bureau of Meteorology, and Catherine Shelfout is here today. Catherine, there's quite a bit of rain to get through. Richard's going to come in and go through the rainfall figures, particularly in the southwest of the Southwest Land Division. So let's kick off in northern and eastern parts before we take a look at what rain might be still on the way for the agricultural zone.
There, Thought we were getting ready to start in the southwest, but the north is fine. A ridge currently over central Australia, so we've got easterly flow over much of the Kimberley and the north interior today. But there is also a trough sitting over the western Kimberley, and that's connected to a trough through central southern WA. So we'll see some moisture getting dragged down along that trough tomorrow. So for today, mostly sunny in the Kimberley, the Pilbara and the interior. We do have a chance for shower or thunderstorm near the northwest Kimberley coast this afternoon, and tomorrow, as I mentioned, we'll see the showers and thunderstorms extending south from the west Kimberley through the interior and to the Eucla, but probably less than 10 millimetres through any of those parts. And I will mention the Gascoyne and the Goldfields because we have this cold front moving over the southwest at the moment. So there's a trough sitting through inland parts of the state, so fresh and gusty northwesterlies ahead of that trough, quite warm through the Goldfields today and the Gascoyne, inland Gascoyne, so around 27 degrees. And we will see some of those showers with the cold front reaching the southwest Gascoyne later today and then extending through the Gascoyne and the Goldfields tomorrow. So not huge totals. Rainfall generally less than 2 millimetres, but maybe up to 5 to 10 millimetres around Norseman. And those thunderstorms are going to hang around for a few days. So we will see them from Friday through to Sunday continuing through the Goldfields and the Eucla.
All right, let's move into the Southwest Land Division. A bit of rain about, as I said a moment ago, in the southwest of the state. But are we seeing any more throughout parts of this part of WA?
Yeah, so there has been. It's quite a slow-moving cold front. So I know Richard will read the figures, but there was several locations inland from Busselton that received more than 50 millimetres this morning. And it's mostly rain, sort of steady rain, but there's some embedded thunderstorms in that system as well. So we still have a severe weather warning out for heavy rainfall, and that's for the areas from Rockingham down to Busselton and inland to around Collie. The system's sort of slowly moving north, and we're starting to see the rainfall through Perth now as well, but it's weakening and it should speed up as well as it moves through and inland. So for the rest of today, we're looking at about 2 to 5 millimetres west of Shark Bay to Bremer Bay and increasing to 15 to 25 millimetres west of about Durian Bay to Albany. And then, of course, you're in that if you're within that warning area, could be more, obviously, 40 or 50 millimetres, but probably that risk sort of easing as we move into later today. And as I mentioned with the Goldfields, also through the eastern wheat belt today, pretty warm and windy ahead of that frontal system. So from tomorrow, we'll see that front decaying, but it does link up with the low and a trough that's currently over the Goldfields. So we also have a ridge that's sort of starting to develop over the southwest corner of the state. So we get that south-southeasterly wind change coming in. But that combination of the southeasterly flow and some mid-level moisture coming down gives us the potential for quite rainy conditions along the south coastal districts tomorrow. So looking at 10 to 20 millimetres for western parts of the Wheat Belt, eastern parts of the Great Southern and some of the southern coastal districts, with the focus of the heaviest rainfall looking to be around Hopetown, Ravensthorpe and Bremer Bay. The models have sort of decreased a little bit from what they were forecasting yesterday, so we could still see 40 to 50 millimetres, but we're going to wait and see what our latest model runs say this afternoon and whether that warrants a severe weather warning for tomorrow. So keep an eye on that. And for the rest of the Southwest Land Division tomorrow, cloudy and rainy, but not huge falls. So 5 to 10 millimetres through remaining parts of the Wheat Belt, the central west south of about Carnarma, and less than 5 millimetres elsewhere. And also quite cold tomorrow, only looking at 13 to 15 degrees through most inland parts. Friday and Saturday, we'll see a ridge moving south of the state, so moderate and possibly gusty southeasterlies on Friday, and they'll start to ease and become east-southeasterly on Saturday. We'll see maximum temperatures increasing a couple of degrees each day over Friday and Saturday, but we still have that upper low and trough complicating things. So both Friday and Saturday, there's still a chance of some showers and a possible thunderstorm. Well, showers over much of the southwest land division, not much though, not very high rainfall, and a chance of a thunderstorm still possible for the wheat belt and far eastern parts of the southwest land division. So only looking at up to 5 millimetres maybe east of about Meriden on Friday, and same sort of area on Saturday, but probably 0 to 3 millimetres. Quite a cold morning on Friday morning for areas around Collie and Wandering, getting down to around 2 to 3 degrees, so a chance of frost there, possibly again Saturday morning. And then finally for Sunday, we will see a high moving into the Bight, a weak west coast trough and pretty light to moderate east-northeasterly winds, so a much warmer day, looking at 21 to 25 degrees across the southwest land division and just up to that sort of 28-degree mark around Mullewa, and just some fog possible near the west coast, but not really any significant rainfall on Sunday.
Thank you so much, Catherine. 19 to 1. Richard Hudson in the studio now to go through the rainfall figures.
Yeah, and it only really seems to have rained south of Perth. So for the entire northern and eastern forecast districts, there was no rain at all. And then in the southwest land division, nothing recorded in the central west. In the lower west, again, it was only south of Perth. So Dwelling Up recorded 16, Mandurah 10, Pinjarra 25 and Waroona 30, and a fair bit around in the rest of the southwest. So the cutoff point is 20 and above. Acton Park 36, Bailing Up 48, Boyan Up North 25, Bridgetown 29, Bunbury 41, Busselton's Airport recorded 32, Cape Naturalist and Capel 42, Chapman Hill 26, Kawarum Up 32, Darden Up at one of the deep herd stations had 23 mils, Donnybrook 39, Doyle Road and Ferguson Valley Alert Station both had 27, Happy Valley Alert Station 53, Harvey 25, Jarrowood 35, Jindong 23, Carriedale 24, Kirrup 54, Loguebrook 46, Ludlow 43, Manjimup 20, Margaret River 21, Mayenup South 34, Millianup and Myallup recorded 21, Mount William 33, Nanup 40, Newbikup 32, Paindale Alert Station 41, Perryvale Orchard and Thompson Brook 57, Ravenscliff Alert Station 58, Rosabrook 23, Scott River and Stonebridge had 21, Vass 32, Warner Glen 20, Willie Abrup and Yanmar had 22, Windy Harbour 21, Worsley Downs 24 and Yungarillup had 30. Bit less around in the southern coastal area, but there was some rain. Albany 6, Amalup and Denbarker 8, Inglebourne 9, Mount Barker 5 and Stirlings North had 4. Nothing recorded in the central wheat belt, and then in the Great Southern, Boscobel and Cherry Tree had 11, Chaming Up 7, Quartering 15, Cranbrook 8, Cranham 7, Darkin 10, Franklin 15, Maradong 8, Quail Up recorded 10, Riverdale 11. And Simon Thomas would certainly love a little bit more rain at his place. He's running a cropping, sheep and cattle farm between Pingrup and Ongrup in the Great Southern, and says at least the forecast looks promising.
Yes, yeah, it looks like we're going to get a rain, and depends which forecast you like. You can look at the optimistic ones, and it looks like a, you know, a really good rain event, but it looks like, yeah, we're in line for something double digits for sure. Year to date, including March, it'd be, we just cracked 130, and you know, our a typical you know, April to our winter rainfall is we've got just over 100 mil. So we were running a bit of a, for a while there, about a bit of a joke who was going to get to the 100 mil mark first, you know. So, but I think the whole farm's now at 100, so you know, onwards and upwards.
Yeah, I'm not sure it'd be a massive celebration getting to your centenary like it is in cricket, but that's Pingrup farmer Simon Thomas speaking to Kate Forrester.
And this text just in from Brian in East Tambalup. He says, that front, it's a really slow-moving front, but he's only had 4 mils reach the bottom of his gauge. So obviously Brian's hoping for more. I hope it gets your way, Brian. It's 16 minutes to 1 o'clock. And Richard, how did you feel this morning when you woke up and just heard that devastating news.
I'm assuming you're referring to Alex Pearce missing out on being selected captain and fullback in the AFL All-Australian team last night.
You know exactly what I'm talking about. It's the news of Dolly Parton's death.
It certainly was a sad way to wake up, and I actually had to break the news to my 18-year-old daughter, and without a word of a lie, she honestly looked like she was just going to burst into tears. Poor old Dolly Parton dying at the age of 80. Her nephew, Brian Seaver, has spoken on behalf of the family, and just have a listen to a little bit of what he had to say.
I first went on the road with Dolly as a kid, getting a taste of the road life in the early 1980s. Dolly opened doors not just for me, but for her entire family to reach the potential we didn't even know was possible. Dolly also opened doors for generations of singers, songwriters, musicians, and dreamers from every walk of life and across every continent. By her example, we believed that anything was possible. She never saw a door she couldn't open, and the doors she opened made and changed history. My family and I have shared a lifetime of beautiful memories with Dolly, but so have you. She has always been on your television, your record player, your CD, and on your phone playlist, becoming an extended part of your family whether you liked it or not. Our family and the team she has entrusted with her legacy will work diligently to ensure her spirit will live with us forever. Dolly was a farmer, just like her daddy. He farmed the soil, she farmed songs and happiness. Dolly called me and said she wants to rest in a beautiful bed of plush cotton because after a life wearing heavy rhinestones, she finally deserves to be comfortable and have some rest. Rest in peace, Aunt Dolly, Aunt Granny, Gigi. May God bless Dolly Parton, and may God bless you all. She will always love you.
So that's Brian Seaver. He's the nephew of Dolly Parton, sharing a message from her family. But back in 1998, Dolly Parton was promoting her album Hungry Again on the talk show Primetime Country when she was asked this question from someone in the audience who may have been a little bit like me, follically challenged.
Sir, what's your name?
Jim Canto.
And you're from?
Right here in Nashville.
All right, Jim. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine, thank you. Good. Dolly, I'd like to ask you a question.
Okay.
I know that you have a lot of experience wearing wigs.
Yeah.
And I wonder, should I use Rogaine, should I get a wig, or should I stay the way I am? What do you think, Dolly?
I think you should stay the way you are, because just because you've lost your fuzz don't mean you're not a peach.
Sharp as a whip, Dolly Parton, and dying the age of 80. She will be missed. The messages are coming in from just everywhere. All the big artists around the world, in the US in particular, just saying how, well, sad it is, but also celebrating her time too and her contributions. 13 minutes to one.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
We head to Katanning just before the news at one for the results of the sheep market. First, though, a Perth butcher says in the last 5 or 6 weeks he's noticed that chicken meat sales have dropped about 25%, and he thinks it's due to concerns over bird flu. Tom Randolph says he's never seen anything like it.
For the 4 years I've been here, chicken has been one of the most reliable and stable product lines that we have, and it's right to the point of all of our orders are on standing orders. It's the same orders coming in week in, week out. But over the last maybe 5 or 6 weeks, we've just seen like the demand or the sort of sales drop by about 20-25%, right? Which is I'm not sure it's affected our business as a whole. And so, I mean, the only thing I can think is people are choosing to eat other things rather than eating chicken. So my, you know, again, I'm kind of, I listened to the ABC in the car, and almost every bulletin has got an update on this bird flu. So, you know, my mind goes, well, this potentially accounts for what I'm seeing over the counter. And I don't even know. So I've certainly talked to customers about it, and everyone says, oh, well, I wouldn't dream of eating less chicken. And yet people are eating less chicken.
So you haven't seen any of that concern come through the customers?
So not the feedback of, right, but, you know, the people I've spoken to is, I wouldn't, you know, hadn't really thought about it. But I think that there's a subconscious effect that happens where people adjust their behaviour according to what's going on around them. I mean, it's not a huge part of our business, right? It might account for 10% of our business. So it's an observable kind of phenomenon. We're losing 20% in a product line, but yeah, it's not going to affect my business.
Yeah, and you made a sort of PSA on social media, speaking about the other feedback you've had from other, like, suppliers.
It's a happenstance conversation with the delivery driver, and says, yeah, all the deliveries are down across the board. And then I was curious, so I spoke to, like, one of the sort of area managers of one of the local supermarket chains, and he said, well, our deliveries are smaller. And I just assumed that there was a supply issue, but most of those deliveries are driven by demand in the supermarket situation, I believe, anyway. So I don't know. It's a very, very few data points. It's only me kind of connecting the dots, if you like.
Yeah.
But I kind of think that regardless of whether it's an actual phenomena or whether it's just a blip in my radar, there is going to come a time when the poultry industry that we all rely on as a protein source, it's one that is very prevalent, certainly when you look at the stats. And I think the customers ought to support the industry now, because it's going to hit some trade winds.
Yeah, and what do you expect the effects of that?
Well, if and when bird flu hits the poultry industry, there's going to be whole flocks that'll need to be put down. And, you know, if that does happen, it's going to affect prices, it's going to affect availability, but also there's a whole bunch of farmers and there's like producers and processing plants that rely on chicken and the sale of chicken for their livelihood. So I reckon now's the time to support, you know, the chicken industry by eating chicken, and not necessarily just from me, just buy more chicken. It's lean and good protein source, tastes nice. Yeah. Get on board.
Chef and butcher Tom Randolph, who runs Meats and Mains in Perth. He was speaking to Lauren Smith, who's also spoken to a few other meat suppliers, and they're saying that they've noticed a similar downward trend in chicken meat sales. One says his chicken meat sales have dropped by about 60%. In the past 3 weeks, so he's obviously placing less orders for chicken. Lauren also contacted the Australian Chicken Meat Federation, but so far it's been reluctant to comment on any possible similar national trends. You can read more online, just search ABC and Perth, and that's where you'll find Lauren's story. 1:08. Rhys Jarrett is president of the West Australian Poultry Association, and he's also noticed a knee-jerk reaction to all the media attention on H5 bird flu.
Yeah, a lot of it is just it's a little bit of fear from exhibitors and from poultry breeders and poultry owners, and everyone's just kind of panicking a little bit, trying to get their birds all covered and protected from bird flu. There is also an increase in people wanting poultry and chickens in their backyards, and we're assuming that's because people are expecting a bit of an impending egg shortage as well. That's if H5N1 gets into the commercial sector, which will impact egg supplies. So people are wanting to really try and produce eggs themselves in the backyard, similar to what we saw a few years ago with those less virile strains of bird flu in Victoria.
With that, you know, demand for backyard chickens, how has that increased?
Yeah, look, it's hard to get an exact number on those because, you know, it's very kind of independent, the backyard poultry supplier or the exhibition poultry breeders. But when talking to a lot of our members across the state, everyone has seen a bit of an increase in people wanting to buy chickens for themselves and to have their own, you know, 3 to 5 chooks in their backyards. And then you also, when you talk to some of the poultry suppliers, you know, there's a few across the state. They're also talking of, you know, a list to try and order new poultry pens to try and enclose backyard flocks, which is so important. We want flocks enclosed and protected from wild birds, but yeah, we are. Oh, those suppliers are reporting an increase in numbers and requests.
Yeah, and so if we're thinking about requests, you know, yourself, maybe what have you experienced? Have you gone from like 2 requests a week to maybe 10 or?
Yeah, look, I'm getting probably about 10 to 15 requests for layers in their backyards every week. And, you know, I'm just an exhibition poultry breeder. I sell my supply into the backyards. And, you know, breeding season is just upon us in September. So I've got nothing available. But, yeah, everyone is trying to get a few hens, I guess, getting ahead of when H5 does make it into the commercial suppliers.
I know you touched on it before, but if we could just go back to the assumption behind that demand, like what could be driving that? Is it egg shortages and prices? Could we get a little...
Yeah. So kind of anecdotally from last time when there were, you know, the less viral outbreaks of bird flu, people panicked then, you know, from the realism that there wasn't enough eggs to supply the Australian market when they started culling or depopulating those commercial flocks. People are wanting to produce their own eggs in the backyards to try and create a secure supply of eggs themselves, which is really driving up that request for more backyard chickens in their own backyards, really. We did see last time there was an outbreak of that H7, that egg prices increased and there was a shortage of eggs, so yeah, people are just trying to get on top of that.
Yeah. Have you seen a demand for this area before in WA?
Yeah, the only other time we really saw it was around COVID, when egg prices increased and when there was that last time there was an outbreak of bird flu in Australia.
Well, with the demand and interest and increase in people buying backyard chickens, what would be some concerns from the industry with that around biosecurity?
Yeah, I guess being that chickens are livestock, we should be practicing livestock biosecurity, whether that's in a commercial enterprise or a backyard scenario. You need an enclosed roof. You need the pens to be draft-free and waterproof. We don't want wet floors in chicken pens. You want good feed. You want clean water to really make sure the birds have the optimal chances of good health. And you want good separation with wild birds as well. So that's why we're seeing an increase in probably those suppliers that are trying to produce these brand new chook pens with enclosed roofs and good mesh on the sides that are vermin proof as well. So yeah, there is that really important factor of owning poultry, is that you need a good setup to look after those birds adequately. They're not just a set and forget pet. Having a good pen that's vermin proof or wild bird proof will certainly put a barrier in place for that to jump over into your birds. It won't eliminate the risk, but it will put a barrier in place. Because if your birds do get H5N1, they will need to be culled. And if they're not culled, they're still going to die. It's a very high fatality rate in domestic poultry. So to protect your pets, have a good pen for them as well.
And so I guess what's next in, you know, what do you expect with the current status of demand? Do you expect that to increase, or how do you expect that to play out?
Yeah, it's hard to really tell. I mean, it probably will increase when or if it does make it into the commercial operations, because there will be an egg shortage. The associations and the boards surrounding poultry production in Australia have said there will be shortages of meat and eggs if it makes it into commercial operations. And once that starts hitting the trolley in the shops or the wallet in the back pocket, there will probably be a demand for backyard poultry again, like what we saw a few years ago when it was in Victoria, New South Wales. But all we really say to people is that make sure that you have good biosecurity practices. If you're owning a chicken, they are livestock. You might think they're a pet, but they're still livestock. They need good biosecurity practices surrounding keeping them.
Rhys Jarrett, he's president of the West Australian Poultry Association, and he was speaking to Lauren Smith. Let's get to the markets, and a much smaller yarding at Katanning today, with 5,981 sheep and lambs penned for sale. That's down 4,369 on last week's numbers. Tracy Kilner, hello. How is the quality today?
A mixed quality yarding with limited heavy lambs available this week. Lamb prices trended down $10 to $30 across our weight categories, with processors selective on dentition. Mutton numbers were down on last sale, with prices fluctuating, seeing the store and medium weight ewes gaining with demand, while our heavyweight ewes were firm, topping at $252 a head. Lambs weighing under 16 kilos carcass weight sold from 50 to 128, and heavier lambs sold to 180. Trade weight lambs made from 146 to 197, while heavyweights under 24 kilos carcass weight sold from 186 to 240, and the heavyweights topped at $250 a head. Ram lambs sold mainly to processors for $40 to $220 weight dependent. Store ewe mutton gain selling from 100 to 184 with a fleece. Prime medium weight ewes returned 172 to 207, and the heavyweight ewes over 30 kilos carcass weight sold from $200 to $252 a head. Mature store wethers returned $140 and heavyweights up to $220 a head. Mature rams made from $41 to $189. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you very much, Tracy. The 1 o'clock news is next.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.